as pure as tin white. When a fatal vision gripped her tight, Cherise, beware tonight. Reuben, Reuben, tell me truly true. I feel afraid and I don't know why I do. Is there another?
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, you have stumbled into The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. A shaggy dog story about life in San Diego in the early 1990s, a printmaker and sculptor by the name of John Broccoli, and an installation in a Catholic church in San Diego completed many, many decades ago. Along the way, we bump into a whole bunch of other stuff, including a little bit of wreckage about faith and God and the nature of life. If you think you might be into some of that, don't leave and settle in for a little while. And if you're just joining, I strongly recommend that you go back and listen to the back episodes. They can be found on The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts on Spotify, or you can listen to the live versions at the KOWS website on The Mountain page. Right now, in this moment, however, we just got ourselves a little bit of rain here in Northern California. And the wise ones are saying that the Pacific Ocean has cooked up to something like 7 degrees above normal. The ocean is basically boiling off and throwing itself at this great nation of ours, pounding us with storms as if to wake us up from the fever dream that has seemed to possess us. Once again, we've threatened to destroy someone else's civilization. I imagine some of us are probably getting a little tired of it all. As part of this radio version of The Mountain, and during this moment, while we're kind of involved in this strange conflagration in the Middle East, I've taken it upon myself to tell some of the 1001 tales of the Arabian Nights, just as an add-on to the story that I'm really telling. For those of you who were listening last week, you may remember that we were telling the story of Scheherazade and how she was beguiling the caliph and trying to save the kingdom by telling him a series of stories. And she had told him about the merchant who had gone on a trip for business and for trade, and on his return, he had sat to eat, and he'd eaten a date, and he had spit out the pit, and the pit had hit the son of a great genie and had killed him, and that the genie had asked to take the merchant's life for this great sin. And so the merchant had gone to say goodbye to his family, and after a year had returned to the spot in the desert where he would await his fate. And we left off a few weeks ago with the moment when an old man had approached with a young deer on a chain, and having heard the merchant's tale, had decided to remain with him. And they were sitting there in the desert in this barren and forlorn place. And another old man came near with two black dogs, and he greeted them. He greeted the merchant and this other old man, and he, of course, inquired, "How are you? And why is it that you are sitting in this place of no great renown, this place that really speaks of nothing?" And the first old man said, "Well, you must understand what happened to my new friend here, the merchant." And he told the merchant's tale and what had happened with the genie and how the merchant had promised to return so that the genie could take his blood in turn for him having taken the genie's son. And the man with the deer on the chain said, he simply reported that he had decided to stay here. He had swore to sit with this merchant until the very end. And the second old man, the man who came with two dogs, he was surprised and absolutely stunned. And he swore in turn. He said, "I too will stay here. I am not going to leave either of you until we see what happens to our dear friend, the merchant." And as he sat down, soon after, a third old man appeared. And they greeted him, and he greeted them back. And he looked at them, and he saw the expression on their countenance, and he asked, why are you all sitting here looking so sad?" And they all in turn told him the merchant's story. And they said, "We are going to sit here And we are not going to abandon him, and we must remain until we see what happens with the jinn. And the third man, he also vowed to stay until the very end. And as they talked, there then rose a great cloud of dust like the smoke of a tremendous explosion. It rose up into the sky and it cleared to show the jinn a steel sword clutched in his hand. And he came near these three men without greeting them. And he pointed to the merchant out with his left hand and he said to him, "Get up so that I may take your life." And the merchant and the three old men, they all began to weep. And then the first old man, the one with the young deer on a chain, he came forward and he kissed the mighty jinn's hands and his feet. And he said, "O crown of the kings of the genie, if I tell you my story, the one with this doe, and if you find it amazing and far stranger and more miraculous than your story with the merchant and of your dead son, will you grant me a third of your claim on his blood?" And the genie said, "I will." So the old man said, but at that moment, the sun gained on the palace of the caliph, and morning broke, and Shahrazad had to cut her story short. "What a strange and miraculous story," Shahrazad's sister Dunyazad said. "If I live to see another night," said Shahrazad, "I shall tell you far, far stranger." And the king, he decided he would spare her till the story's end, and he would wait one more day to kill her. Shouting at this lovely girl, So picture this. New Year's Eve, on the eve of 1989, a year before we moved back to San Diego from Seattle, 2 years before John began work on the chapel, the Grateful Dead, the Oakland Coliseum. We were not in our right minds. We leaned on a parapet overlooking the loading dock for the arena. The show had let out 1 or 2 in the morning, and the bus village was electrified and alive. The thrum of drums echoed off the loading dock walls. Anna leaned toward me. She spoke softly. "Look at him. Look at him," she said. She pointed to a man dervishing in a manic circle below us. Spit shot from between his teeth like a stream of venom. "Do you see?" she said. "He's a snake. He's the serpent man. He's evil." "Don't worry," I whispered. "I'll take care of this." I stepped away and pushed through the crowd and made my way somehow down to the throng of dancers below us. Because the eagle must seize the snake. This had been foretold, that the eagle, that thing that commanded the sky, would grasp in its talons the snake, the water bearer, the guardian of the underworld. The eagle had seized the snake, and it was in that place in Mexico that the great city of Tenochtitlan had been born. So there, in that concrete pit at the entrance to the Oakland Coliseum, I threw myself into battle. I spun in equally mad circles around and around and around, tightening my orbit around the Serpent King, who seemed to spin ever more quickly. In a final turn, I threw my arms forward, and the Serpent King, he spun out, cast outward, out into the periphery, and right into the concrete wall of the loading dock. And there he collapsed. I bowed, and exhausted, I returned back up to the parapet where Anna waited. "Did you see?" I asked. "Did you see?" "See what?" she asked. "I vanquished the Serpent King," I whispered. "I threw him against the wall. The Serpent King, he is no more," I said. "What are you talking about?" Anna asked. This is your host, Andrew Lewis. Welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. We sat on the mustard-colored sofa, bathed and in our pajamas. It was 1969 or 1970, perhaps a year before our father was to die. But we didn't know yet that this would happen. We watched the Magnavox. It was 7 o'clock on Sunday night, and the wonderful world of Walt Disney had begun. The people in the spinning teacups, Mickey and Minnie, the beautiful fireworks lighting up the sky above Snow White's castle. That evening's episode took place in the desert. There was an Indian boy. There was an eagle. The boy was supposed to take the life of the eagle, but he would not do it. The eagle was his friend. The other children, they teased him. They chased him up the side of a cliff. The boy stood on the cliff, and he had nowhere to go. And so he leapt off the precipice. And as he soared, he became that eagle. My brother and I watched captivated, but I was scared. I was so scared for that little boy. Scared because he would be all alone. Scared for how he would survive in the world. Scared for all that would happen to him. For years afterward, I would think of him, and I would wonder. 3 decades pass. I sit in my friend's home. His house is on a mesa. He's of the Bear Clan. His wife, the mother of his children, are of Eagle. It's late at night, and we are talking about farming, about Hopi farming, and about Hopi values, about that code of ethics with concepts that we don't have a language for. Sumit Nungwa, the coming together to engage in activities for the benefit of all. Nimit Nungwa, helping in a time of need without having to be asked and without expecting compensation for the deed. Hitat Nungwa, to care for something without having to be instructed or to be asked. This accounting of values was described by my friend's father-in-law, whose name was Stanford. Beyond my friend, in the background, a TV. And then, for a moment, I focus on what is playing on the screen. A small boy. He stands on the edge of a cliff. He spreads his arms. He leaps. He begins to fall. His arms transform into wings, and he soars. What the hell, I shout at my friend. What the hell is that doing in here? My friend laughs and smiles. That's Stanford, he says. When Stanford was little, he played the boy in that movie. So he didn't die, I ask. No, my friend says. No, he did not die. Decades later, more than 5 decades after our father's death, 5 decades after my brother was beaten on the kitchen floor. My brother, he lives on the streets. He more or less has no home. He's in the hospital. He has diabetes. He passed out and he broke his pelvis and other bones. I'm in Santa Cruz with him. I speak on the phone with a young woman. She is barely 25. She has called me from a federal facility in Minnesota. It's Stanford's granddaughter, and she had been sentenced to 16 years in prison when she was 16 years old. There in the hospital, I tell her about my brother and how he's sick. She doesn't even hesitate before she speaks. She says she will run in the prison yard for him, and that she will pray. And she asked me for his address. Weeks later, a letter arrives. My brother doesn't know the person from whom it has come, but he could see that the letter is from a prison and he wants to treat it with care. He takes the letter to a coffee shop. There he sits and he opens and reads the first page of the letter. The letter that had been written by the granddaughter of the Eagle Boy, who so long ago had once soared through the sky, through the Magnavox television, and straight into our childhood consciousness. The angel of death, she writes from her prison cell, can teach us how to truly be alive. My brother, now a 60-year-old man, sits in the coffee shop in Santa Cruz, and he stares at that page. His attention is broken by 2 complete strangers who approach him. "Excuse us," one of them says. "Excuse us for bothering you," he says, "but can we ask you a question?" "Sure," my brother says, "sure. You can ask me a question. Do you believe in a higher power?" the man asks.
Almost fell. felt you touching me just now. Wish I knew which way to turn and go. Feel so good, then I feel so bad. Wonder what I ought to do. If I could only fly, if I could only fly, I'd bid this place goodbye. Come and be with you. I can hardly stand, I got nowhere to run. Another sinking sun, another lonely night. The wind keeps blowing somewhere every day. Tell me things get better somewhere up the way. Just dismal thinking on a dismal day. Sad songs for us to bear. Sometimes I write happy songs, but then sometimes little things are wrong. You know, I wish they all could make you smile. Tomorrow maybe we can get away. Coming home soon and I want to stay. Wish you could come with me when I go again. If I could only fly, if I could only fly, I'd bid this place goodbye to come and be with you. I can hardly stand, I got nowhere to run. Another sinking sun, one more lonely night. If I could only fly, if you could only fly, only fly, there'd be no more lonely nights.
It's doubtful that the disciple John, Christ's most beloved, wrote the Gospel of John. He was an illiterate fisherman, after all. But to think he wrote it is pleasing. The eagle would come to represent him because such did his prose soar. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In the beginning was the Word, as if the world was simply spoken into being. That the statement is not only not apart from the thing, but it is the very thing. So great is the statement that nothing can precede it. For a brief time in the 1990s, I taught English at a local community college. On that very first day of class, I felt so terrified. I had no authority. I had nothing to teach. And in my charge was a room of students, some just out of high school, some in their 20s, some older than me, all of them in a 101 class, hoping basically, to learn how to use the English language. It was a tall order. They were perhaps even more terrified than I was. That first day, I didn't know what to do except to perhaps just acknowledge their fear, to acknowledge that they may not yet know how to talk about stories and words. So for the first assignment, I handed to the students the first chapter from The Sound and the Fury. I asked them to read it, but to not try to understand it. Instead, I asked them to note each thing that they did not understand. Their assignment was simply to assemble a list of questions. The less you understood, the more questions you would have, and whoever had the most questions would win. Just imagine their minds as they read these words. It was red, flapping on the pasture. Then there was a bird slanting and tilting on it. Luster through, the flag flapped on the bright grass and the trees. I held to the fence. Shut up that moaning, Luster said. I can't make them come if they ain't coming, can I? If you don't shut up, Mammy ain't gonna have no birthday for you. If you don't hush, you know what I gonna do. I gonna eat that cake all up, eat them candles too, eat all of them, 33 candles. Now, come on, let's go down to the branch. I got to find my cord, or maybe we can find one of them bars. Here they is, way over yonder, see? He came to the fence and pointed his arm. See them? They ain't coming back here no more. Come on. At the next class on Wednesday, the excitement in the room was palpable. It seemed that nearly everyone had something to say. Not one of them, not a single one, had understood a bit of the text. And so all of them had pages and pages of questions. I asked them to read them out loud. What is the curling flower fence? What are they hitting? Who is Luster? What are the flags? Who is moaning? Why is he moaning? And on and on and on. It grew to a cacophony of questions. And then, among the voices, one student shouted out, "Who is I?" And there I stopped them. "There you go," I said. "That's the question. Who am I? And who is I?" In part, The Sound and the Fury, in its complex entirety, struggles to answer that very question. We cannot understand unless we first have a question. "Don't be afraid to not know," I said. "Don't be afraid to interrogate," I said. "Because that's how you one day will come to know. Success comes in not knowing, in reveling in not knowing, in trusting not knowing. In the beginning was not the word. In the beginning was the question, a question asked without form in a dimensionless space, in a language beyond our current reckoning. And the question begat the word. We and the entirety of all that is the answer to that question.
Lacy golden promises you made while I was young. Later briars and brambles set me on the run. Just the sound in the dust, dry boots led me on to the place where unknown serpents curled and fled the dawn. Ah, mystery, oh mystery, why do you treat me so? To raise another devil, and with the devil go. Down with your false rebellion, shaking through the trees, from wooden horse to hellion, to bring us to our knees. Red wind burning for the night says you love us so.
You have caused the time to pass. You're even in the snow. Oh, mystery, how can you treat me so? Raise another devil, and with the devil go. With the devil go. I've been sorting out a plan to leave you far behind. I'm certain that the cause of it isn't always kind. You're a blank for filling in. I give you nothing more. Mystery in the shadows, standing by the door. Oh mystery, how can you treat me so? To raise another devil, and with the devil go. With the devil go.
The eagle did soar, or at least it tried to. John had gone from doodles and scribbling to something that might be called art after high school, when he enrolled at Mesa College in San Diego. One of his first art teachers was a young sculptor herself, Trina Dixon. She'd come from Kansas and had begun working in clay when studying on the East Coast. Eventually, she made her way to San Diego, where she would teach art at Mesa College and San Diego State. She was thin, attractive, a pert face, a welcoming smile. When she saw John's work, she took him under her wing. She told him that he needed to master his technique. He had to understand forms. He needed to be able to paint and sculpt realistically. She pushed him to learn portraiture, and he learned to sculpt in clay. He sculpted his mother and family members. Eventually, Trina came to John with a proposition. They could trade time. He would model for her for an hour, and then she would model for him. They grew close. Trina would later marry, and she and her husband would form a working and romantic partnership that would last for nearly 30 years. But it was Trina who had encouraged John to go on to San Diego State and then to Long Beach. It was she that had done the sculpture of St. Elizabeth Seton mounted in the foyer of the church. And it was she who had encouraged John to make a proposal to Father Don. Trina and her husband James would make sculptures of Cesar Chavez and other California historical figures, and they would mount a photo exhibition depicting the lives of a migrant worker family. Trina and John would eventually have a falling out. They would not speak for years. But then, in 2019, Trina unexpectedly reached out to him. Unannounced, she and Jim dropped by John's garage studio in Mission Hills. Trina was in a cheery mood. She wanted to see him. She wanted to say hi, but also there was an underlying discomfort. She had been one of the first to believe in him. And now, here she was with her husband. She wanted to know how he had been. It was important to her. They chatted. They looked at his current work and took interest. It was a not unpleasant afternoon. The following day, Trina J. Dixon would die. Her surviving husband put up for auction a single piece. It sold for far less than its estimated value. In clay, it was of a young, thin male figure kneeling prostrate on the ground, head face down and clutched in his hands. In a fetal position, the figure was also in supplication. The scapula, an exposed shoulder and tucked arm, felt real. The model's face, hidden, said more, perhaps, than if it were ever exposed.
All the other girls here are stars. You are the Northern Lights. They try to shine in through your curtain. You're too close and too bright. They try and they try, but everything that they do is the ghost of a trace of a pale imitation of you. I'll be the one to drive you back home, Kathleen. This party was made with the night air and the chance that a smile will wipe its way from your face to one of the boys in your line. Well, you act like you're hip to their tricks and you're strong, but a virgin, wordlets are hard, never once had a song. I'll be the one to drive you back home, Kathleen. And I'll have you back by break of day. I'm going your way anyway. And if you'd like to come along, I'll be yours for a song. Oh, oh, oh. Back into your room, and I'll coast down the length of your drive by the light of the moon. And the next time we meet's a new kind of hello. Both our hearts have a secret. Only both of us know about the night that I.
In the end, John was happy with neither the eagle nor the lion. They were good, they were realistic, but even so, he had missed something. What he thought was, in fact, not. The mane of the lion felt too made up, too contrived and plastic. The images were as good as they were going to get. Yet John didn't know the eagle. The lines emulated that critical thing, but he did not know how to capture the essence of that thing. He didn't understand it, and so he committed that cardinal sin. Like his predecessors, he was just making stuff up. At night, John would walk his dog Sadie beneath the yellow sulfur glow of the street lamps that lit Mission Hills. The air sometimes redolent with the smell of skunks that had come up from the canyon, and while crossing the street would be flattened beneath the wheel of a speeding car. Sometimes he would spy foxes and possums that wandered the neighborhood. Why was John drawn to animals? What question was John asking? Perhaps he was just trying his best to give form to the anguish, the haunting of those things that carry within them the spirit, yet are the very beings that we have turned away from the feast, that the creatures that we do not heed or that we scorn, the ones upon which we dine when we sit at the table. One night, the panels of the tetramorph would be finished. When they were eventually mounted in the chapel arch, the three beasts and the angel of man would gaze down with a remove, but also a sadness, as if they are about to weep but are powerless to do so. They gaze downward toward the sacrificed man as he ascends to heaven, but also they seem to gaze down with ambivalence at the congregation. Ambivalence, yes, but also with an unaccountable sorrow.
When I first set eyes on you, first you beat me up, then you kissed me too. We throw stones into the sea. There were no others there, just you and me. Across the bridge, down the lane. I knew I loved you then, you said you did the same. Oh, Maggie, what have you done? I should have seen it coming. To your side I'd run. Oh, Maggie, come to me tonight. I will wait up for you, make sure you're all right. I miss you. You taught me how to sink or swim. When I was scared that day, you just pushed me in. When nobody was around, you let me kiss you then. There, the love I found. I said I'd never let you go. You just smiled at me. How is I to know? Oh, Maggie, what am I to do? How can I live with only memories of you? Oh, Maggie, tell me the truth. When your ship was sinking, did you think it through? I miss you. You were the fountain of my youth. And when I fumbled, you showed me what to do. And when we were both 17, left me standing there, but you were never mean. And when I saw you out with him, he looked much older, and you looked very thin. I hadn't heard from you in years. And then your mama called, she couldn't speak for tears. She said you left me a note. Inside my pocket burns these words you wrote. Hey, darling boy, don't you cry for me. I am forever yours now that I am free. We'll be together, throw stones into the sea. There'll be no others there, just you and me. I miss you. Maggie's gone. Night. of light may have only been a dream, but I will walk with you to places I never have been. Maggie's gone.
You have been listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts.
Before sending you on your way, I can't help but give a shout out to Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!, who actually happened to be in Sebtown on Monday, this past Monday. She is such a tremendous promoter of independent storytelling, independent news, and independent community radio stations such as KOWS 92.5, which actually is one of the affiliates that streams Democracy Now! If you missed the movie, I encourage you to check out Healdsburg True West Film Center, which will be screening the film as well beginning Friday, May 8th. You can learn more about Amy Goodman's crusade to take on politicians and corporate media in a fearless pursuit of the truth in this documentary by Oscar-nominated filmmakers Carl Diehl and Tia Lesson. You can find out more about the documentary and the story behind the hard questions that Democracy Now! Has asked on the front lines of global conflicts and social duress. Visit stealthisstory.org for more information about tickets and screenings in your area. Again, this is highly recommended.
Today's songs include Ruben and Charisse as sung by the Jerry Garcia Band, the Bob Dylan tune from the John Wesley Harding album As I Went Out One Morning, as sung by Mira Bilot on the I'm Not There soundtrack. If you go to the Mountain Substack, you can find yet another haunting version of this song, sung by David Eugene Edwards in the KEXP studio in Seattle. You had If I Could Only Fly, performed live by the much-missed Blaze Foley at the Austin Outhouse in 1988. Foley himself had, for much of his life, been without a home. Mystery by Jackson C. Frank from his American Troubadour album. We also heard Kathleen by Josh Ritter and Maggie by Colin Hay. I'll be sending you on your way with Never One Thing by May Erlewine. If you're enjoying these stories, you may want to consider subscribing to The Mountain on Substack to stay abreast of all things mountain, as well as catch up on the backlog of chapters in this unwinding story. You can find it by Googling The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. If you have questions or comments, I would love it if you emailed me at anadoration@gmail.com. anadoration@gmail.com. You can also hear the podcast version of these stories at The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts on Spotify. And, as always, if you enjoyed the listen and it makes your world a little bigger, I would be grateful if you would share with your friends. Please have a great day or a good night wherever and whenever you are in this dear world.
I'm the underbelly, I am the claw, never one thing, no, not one thing at all. I'm a street fighter, I'm a prayer for peace, I'm a holy roller, I'm a honeybee. I am the truth, I am a lie, I am the ground, I am the sky, I am the silence, I am the call, never one thing, no, not one thing at all. I'm the underbelly, I am the claw. Never one thing, no, not
You have been listening to KOWSLP at 92.5 FM, your favorite number, broadcasting from Occidental, California. Our email address is kows@sonic.net. You can also give us a like on Facebook at facebook.com/kows.fm. And you have been listening to The Mountain, an Adoration in a Multitude of Parts with your host, Andrew Lewis. This is a streaming, serialized, multi-part story. If you want to catch up on previous episodes, you can go to the KOWS website and look at archive shows. Or you can go to the Mountain, an Adoration Substack. And find links there as well. Hope you're well, and hope you have...
It's 2 o'clock.
This is KOWS, Occidental, California, 92.5 FM, streaming at kowsfm.com. Thank you for listening to us. We are community radio for the west of Sonoma County, and we always practice free speech and no bull.